And now a look at growing up Muslim in America. Our guest is Ayed Akhtar, author of the new book, American Dervish. The rights to the book have already been sold in 21 countries, and a huge promotional campaign is in place. American Dervish focuses on a young boy who grows devout in his faith, but sees that faith evolve when he meets extremists who are anti-Semitic. Ayed Akhtar is an American-born, first-generation Pakistani-American from Milwaukee. He's the author of numerous screenplays and was a star and co-writer of The War Within. And he starred in the HBO movie Too Big to Fail about the financial crisis. American Dervish is his first novel, and it's a pleasure to have you here. Welcome to Kansas City.
Thank you, sir. It's good to be here.
You wanted to write this book. Why?
You know, I wanted to write a book that was going to begin the process of telling the Muslim American experience, and doing that in the sort of literary tradition of immigrant literature in America. I'd been so affected growing up by, you know, the Jewish American writers who I'd first encountered, you know, when I was in my early teens and then my later teens, and the way that they kind of forged a place for Jewish American experience. And I felt that that process should sort of get underway. Maybe it was a little, I don't know, maybe I was taking on something a little bigger than my britches, but it's that's generally the way I am. I just felt like, you know what, might as well begin that process. Something I'd wanted to do for a while, and then I sort of sat down and just did it.
And that's obviously a very big idea. Mm-hmm. So how did you create something that can convey what you wanted to convey?
It was a story that had been with me, as has been with me for a long time. And I think that the sort of the key thing for me was coming up with a way, a voice that was really going to be inclusive, telling a story that was both American and familiar, a dysfunctional family story, an immigrant story, a conversion narrative that has, you know, certain redemptive themes, but at the same time beginning to weave in more foreign elements, like, for example, meditations on the Quran and Islamic aesthetics and all of those sorts of things that the American public wouldn't know anything about, but that they would get introduced to. So it's a book that's both very familiar and I think also very different.
Does it bother you that Americans know so little?
You know, not really. I grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and you know, the folks that I grew up with were smart, good people, well-intentioned. It's one of those things where you just, if you don't have a lot of experience with a certain community of people, then there really isn't any reason to know much about them.
Yeah, but in the wake of 9/11, in the wake of the world as it's changing, in the wake of a lot of things, the way this country is changing, is it a little more incumbent on many of us to sort of get with it a little bit?
But I think we are. I think that's sort of what's happening. Yeah. And I think, you know, post 9/11, the question of who Muslims are and what are they all about, what do they think, and you know, that's become a much more pressing issue. And I think that, you know, of course, there's a lot of negativity there, but there has also been a lot of positivity, as, for example, this kind of support that I've gotten with the release of this book.
You know, I had the impression reading about you, reading this book, that there are elements in this book that are very much autobiographical. Am I right?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. Yeah. Such as?
Well, growing up, I grew up in Milwaukee. The book is set in Milwaukee. A lot of the textures and the sort of experiences of growing up, the day-to-day life, all that's taken from my life. I mean, so many of the characters are composites of folks that I knew, you know, maybe not one person, but maybe two or three people. Everything in the book, it's safe to say, is something that I either saw, witnessed, or experienced myself firsthand. But all of it's kind of been transmuted and reformulated into a good story, because as a storyteller, basically that's the imperative thing, is that I got to tell a good story. And sometimes what actually happened in life isn't quite sharp enough for to keep the pages turning.
Yeah. And Milwaukee for you, by and large, was a pretty good experience?
Yeah, wonderful. I mean, you know, I think
because my impression, boy, this is, you know, I'm going out there a bit. Lots of great people in Milwaukee, but I wouldn't think, I think the potential to have a difficult experience in a city like Milwaukee might be rather strong.
Yeah, you know, I hear what you're saying, but by the same token, I never had that experience. For me, basically, again, like I said, the folks that I grew up with were good, smart people, and really, whether you like the Green Bay Packers or not, was really in many ways more important than anything else. And
I know that. I went to school at Madison, so I know exactly what you're talking about.
Oh, you did? Yeah. Madison's a great town.
Yeah.
Very different than Milwaukee.
Very different than Milwaukee, yeah.
And so basically, I mean, I think the thing that I felt growing up, and I wouldn't say that I bemoan this because I feel like it's been very helpful for me as an artist, but I did feel like an outsider in the sense that I felt like, you know, what was going on inside my house, the kinds of things that I was hearing, the kinds of, you know, things that I was eating. All of that stuff was very different than, you know, when I'd go and stay over at my friends' houses.
I was going to say, you were very much alone in that way.
Yeah, for sure.
And how did that fit with you?
Well, I think that that sort of inculcated a kind of, you know, observing position in me, really being a witness of things, really thinking things through, contemplative. You know, I think that maybe had I wanted my nature kind of gravitated a different direction, it might have been more of an impediment.
But were the kids that you hung with, were they curious?
Not really.
About you and what all this was?
Not for the most part. But I think that
were they put off by it?
They were not. But I would also say that I think early in my adolescence, I realized that to become part of the larger sort of American majority that was, you know, in my high school and sort of being able to sort of be friends with the popular kids and whatnot, all of those sort of negotiations, I constantly made the decision to assimilate. Mm-hmm. That was the decision that I always made. So I never really advertised my difference, as it were. And I think that one of the things that what I perhaps bring to the table as an artist is somebody who understands, I really do understand the rules of belonging in both worlds, mm-hmm. because I've really strived to understand both of those worlds.
And the kids who sort of take a stand and sort of tell their cohorts that I am different, those are the kids who a lot of times struggle.
Yeah.
You know, and they don't assimilate. They don't sort of inculcate themselves, you know?
That's right. And for the most part, I can't really take that much responsibility for it, in the sense that really it was my father who was so insistent about difference not being the important matter, that really the only way that you were going to get anywhere in life in this country was to really take yourself up by the bootstraps and just do it. And that whatever folks might be saying about who you are was ultimately not going to define who you are, because this country was really about excellence. So that was inculcated in me from a very young age. But again, as I say, my experience was wide, and I think that understanding the community that I came from and having compassion for some of the struggles that I saw a lot of the people go through, that's been an important part of my artistic journey.
Ayed Akhtar is our guest. He's the author of American Dervish, a new book that's getting a whole lot of attention. What do you make of the attention your book has gotten? And it's sort of being sold in, what I said, 21 different countries.
25 now.
25. I'm already behind the curve.
Yeah.
Nice problem to have.
Thanks. Yeah, no kidding.
What do you make of it?
You know, it's funny. I wrote this book, and I didn't really – it took me 4 years to write it, and I had a day job writing screenplays, and I had a production company at the time, and I was writing in the mornings and the evenings, and I didn't expect anybody to read the book. I mean, I was just hoping
What keeps you going in a situation like that? Because you hear authors say that sometimes, and if it was me, I'd be sitting there thinking, unless this book's a bestseller, I ain't going to do it.
Yeah.
And you're thinking just the opposite.
You know, I think it's this weird need that you have as an artist to push your understanding and to share your understanding. And of course, there's a selfish element of wanting to be acknowledged for having said something worthwhile and important and having contributed in a cultural way. That's always been part of my dream. You know, I had this amazing high school teacher in junior year of high school. It completely changed my life and made me want to become a writer. And really, from that point forward, I have never wanted to do anything else. I remember reading that thing that John Lennon once said, life is what happens to you while you make other plans.
Yeah.
And I made sure that there were no other plans being made. I mean, I threw myself into what I've been doing.
What did that teacher do for you?
You know, she opened up the question that you – she opened up the possibility you could ask the question of what the meaning of life was. Like until that point in my life, you know – nobody had ever asked. Nobody ever thought about that. Nobody ever articulated that to me. But she, in story after story in this class, we would talk about the most profound things about why, what was it, what was the rightful use of our freedom? What was the best kind of life to live?
Wow.
And at the age of 16 and 17 years old, and she had changed so many kids' lives. I mean, she was an amazing woman. When I met her, she was in her late 50s. She'd been through 5 husbands. She lived on 60 acres north of Milwaukee in the forest, where she had a farm-sized garden and 10 Great Danes who she would walk every morning before coming to school. When she walked into class, she had this regal bearing that was not affectation. It was like, I realize now looking back, she was the first person I ever encountered who had – who embodied this quest for authenticity. And she just by the force of her being changed so many kids' lives, and she changed mine. So from that,
does she know that she changed your life?
Oh yeah, for sure. And she knows she's changed so many kids' lives. Yeah, I reached out to her. I had a film that came out in Milwaukee a few years ago, The War Within. Well, it came out around the world, but when it came out in Milwaukee,
right.
I reached out to her and sort of I've been actually thinking of calling the Milwaukee Journal and asking if I can write a profile about her because I know she's still around. Yeah, it just occurred to me yesterday because I was telling the story to one of the patrons over at St. Paul's Episcopal where we're doing an event tonight.
Yeah.
And she was saying, oh, you know what? Has anybody ever written that story? I said, no. She said, yeah, she might really appreciate it if you were to do that.
That needs to get done.
Yeah, I think so.
That is such an incredibly rare thing and what a shame that it is. But it is.
No, it is.
Yeah.
So anyway, so that's what kept me going, the dream, the sense that I didn't have anything to fall back on and I had staked my entire sort of being and future on this quest to try to give shape to my experience in a meaningful way.
Ayed Akhtar will be speaking tonight at 7 at St. Paul's Episcopal Day School. He just mentioned this. That's at 4041 Main Street. The event is sponsored by Rainy Day Books and Fairway. For tickets, call 913-384-3126. You know, you once told NPR that you were obsessed with what the Quran meant and that it was really an important part of your childhood. Why did you become obsessed with it and this idea of sort of trying to pursue these big questions you just were referring to? I gather there's a connection there somehow.
I think there is. You know, while I was writing American Dervish, I was reading a lot of Jonathan Edwards, the great Puritan theologian from the 17th century, one of the great religious minds of the American tradition. And he wrote this wonderful book, a small book called Personal Narrative, which is really the story of how he came to the Lord. And I remember reading it and thinking to myself, he was talking about experiences that he'd had as a young boy, the sweetness and the intensity of his love for God and how it would manifest in his walks through the forest and as he was gazing at the sky. And I remember thinking to myself, that's so much like my childhood. I was so sensitive for some reason to the splendor and the expansiveness of creation and of life. And there was really nothing. My parents were secular Muslims. They were, you know, not particularly practicing, both scientists. There was nothing in my household that could resonate with that depth of experience. The only thing in our house that really I could go to that gave me a sense of trying to being able to understand what this was the Quran. And so my passion for spiritual texts, the Quran, you know, and then later the Old Testament, the New Testament, the Bhagavad Gita, the Buddhist sermons, all of that stuff began in my childhood out of my own sort of personal quest to try to understand what was going on.
It sounds like it was a very personal quest as opposed to being driven from somebody else.
For sure. Yeah. No, it was completely personal. And but that said, as a young boy, as I began to sort of get more and more deeply into the Quran, I also began to run into a different version of the faith, which is maybe, you know, we could call it the literalist orthodoxy, which sort of approaches faith less as an inquisition or a quest for understanding and more as a way of following rules and more as a way of defining identity. And that's one of the points of view on faith in the book, American Dervish. There's a couple of others. I mean, it really is.
Hayat,
yeah.
Your central figure deals very much with what you just said.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes.
You see his transformation, the arc of his thinking as you go through the book.
Yeah. Because he finds his way into the Muslim faith through an encounter with this beautiful, brilliant Pakistani woman who comes to live with his family after she's fleeing a horrible divorce in Pakistan. She comes here to rebuild her life, and she's one of those people who sort of changes the way you think. You know, I remember Robert Wise, the editor in Hollywood, talking about being around Orson Welles, and he used to say, you know, it was the first time I experienced what real genius, being around a real genius is like. You would have different thoughts when you were in his presence.
You know, that's such an interesting idea to me, based on your experience with your teacher in high school and everything else, because, as I said, it is just such a rare thing anymore.
You really don't come
across it as much as you'd like to. Unfortunately, doing the show and visiting with folks like you, you do get that opportunity. But, boy, in everyday life, it doesn't seem to happen as much as it should somehow.
And it's the special salt of life. It's the thing that it's the thing we remember. It's the thing that changes us.
And you walk away and when I talk to my kids tonight, I'll talk about meeting you and those experiences are the ones that just stand out. So I met this guy today, he said this. What do you think of that?
Yeah,
you know,
right.
And
that's just
doesn't happen as much as it should somehow. You know?
So this happens to young Hyatt when he's 11 and she comes into his life. And the paradox about her is that she's both devout, but also really enlightened. She has her own perspective on Islam. She practices it in this unique way.
Yeah.
And she begins to teach him about his faith. So the spiritual dimension of the faith gets transmitted to him at a very young age. But as he begins to spend more and more time on his own with the Quran, he actually also begins to spend more time with the more Orthodox community in Milwaukee, and then ends up sort of becoming kind of a little fundamentalist for a while. And that's really the drama of the book turns around some of the things that he does out of his fundamentalist sort of jealousy and fury.
And obviously you're speaking to what larger concerns you might have about Muslim, the community and the Quran and how it can be used and abused and everything else.
Absolutely. And I think in a larger sense, also speaking about the polarization that is existing in so many communities.
Yeah.
I've had the good fortune of having received emails since the book has been published. It was a pastor out in California who sent me a copy of his sermon that was drawing on Mina, this character that I was mentioning, many of the things she says about God. And I found it quite remarkable that this pastor was addressing his Christian parish, his Christian congregation, with texts from a Muslim woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of people of faith have connected to the book in that way because it really is fundamentally a book about religious faith. It's about faith and doubt. You know, one of the things that I think people, they have this misperception or they have this perception about Islam that Muslims somehow are inured to doubt, that they don't have doubt the way that everybody else does, that the nature of that faith is somehow different, that it will induce people to do things that others would never think that they would be able to do.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is that for the most part, Muslims go through the same kinds of experiences in their questioning of their faith and their confusion and their raptures and their confusions. I mean, it's the same that we all experience. So like I said, in many ways, I really just wanted to write a book about religious experience in America, but from the Muslim point of view.
Ayed Akhtar is our guest. He's the author of American Dervish, his first novel. If you have questions about our conversation, 816-235-2888. Our email address is up to date at kcur.org or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Joe from Lenexa, thanks for holding on, Joe.
Hi.
Good morning.
Unfortunately, about the only exposure I have to the Muslim faith is through news accounts in the newspapers and magazines about the wars going on in the Middle East. And so much of what I read about is the Sunnis and the Shias and the Kurds and the different sects of the Muslim faith. And I was wondering if you could explain the difference in the Muslim faith between a Sunni and a Shia, and why there's so much oppression of one sect over the other, and if those sects exist in the United States. Thank you.
Yeah, Joe, thank you.
Wonderful question,
yes.
Joe. The basically what it boils down to, the difference between Sunnis and Shias is really pretty simple. What happened is that when in the 7th century, when the Prophet Muhammad, supposedly received revelation from God and began a community of believers, those believers were essentially a unified community. Now, the Prophet was the sole spiritual and political authority for those group of followers. When he passed away, there was a crisis of succession. And so there was no plan, as it were. There was no written will as to how political and religious authority and spiritual authority was going to be practiced amongst the community. And there was one group of people who believed that it should be done by measure, essentially by some version of a democratic election, and those are the Sunnis. And then there was another faction of folks who believed that it should pass through familial succession in the next person in Muhammad's family, and that's the Shia sect. Now, neither is, of course, I use the word democratic, and there might be some sense that I think that one is superior to the other, but I really don't, because I think it's a very deep and profound question that is being asked about what the nature of spiritual authority is, and that perhaps in the Shia tradition, there is a sense that there is still a living link to the Lord. There is still a living link to the mysterious source, whereas in the Sunni tradition, there's basically the acceptance that, okay, the Prophet died, and now we just got to figure out how to get on with things.
Mm.
So I think there's disadvantages and advantages to both sides. Now, what ended up happening historically is that Sunnis have often been in power more – because they also are a larger number. And so there has been oppression, political oppression. You know, I won't belabor the long history of that, but there's basically been a political oppression. And it's in some ways, you know, tantamount to the kind of history that you see with the Protestants and Catholics in Europe, you know, post-Reformation.
You know, the New York Times had such an interesting piece about you last month in which the story began with you gently dissuading your agent, the writer of the piece and a photographer, from sitting in a certain chair. Tell us about the importance of that chair in your life. I love this story.
Yeah. I have a lot of quirky writing habits, and one of them is that—
wrong with that.
Yeah,
nothing wrong with that.
I guess not.
Yeah.
My friends have been teasing me since that article came out.
It's a hard thing to do. Yeah.
So, you know, one of the things that I do is that I'll keep a chair empty and I will, you know, I will designate that chair as the presence of one of the characters in my story. And I'll sort of allow that chair to take on what feels like the presence of that person. Sometimes over the course of days, I'll just leave the chair empty. I'll be with the chair. And then I'll feel that at some point there's something for me to learn by sitting in it. It's almost like sitting in the skin of another person, as it were, an imaginative space. And a lot of my best revelations, most unexpected surprises about something that a character does or thinks or feels comes from that moment where I encounter that otherness.
That's a really hard process, it sounds like. And intense progress.
It is, and but it's fun. It definitely requires me to sort of stay focused and concentrated. But you know, I've had a lot of years practicing. As I said, John Lennon's advice was, you know, don't have any other plans. So,
well, you also have a writing ritual that involves taking lots of baths.
You know,
friends are listening, here it comes again.
Friends and not friends. I was at a book party the other night for A.M. Holmes, who's got a wonderful book out this week. Brilliant writer, but she had a book party in New York, and I was there and was introducing myself to a couple of people, and one of the folks who was there said, "Oh no, you know, you don't need to introduce yourself to me. I know who you are. I just read the article in the Times." I said, "Oh really?" He said, "Yeah, you're pretty clean, aren't you?" you know, I think that the process of writing is about, you know, working real hard on a problem that you can't solve and then releasing so that your unconscious can begin to work out the solution without you thinking about it. And one of the things that has helped me to sort of release and relax is to take baths. Now, there was one occasion when I was in Chicago and I was, you know, doing rewrites for a play that I was doing in Chicago, and I needed to be up 20 hours straight. And I required over the course of those 20 hours to take 4 baths. Now, that I had mentioned to a friend who is now in my play at Lincoln Center,
yes,
who was interviewed by the Times.
Yes.
And he somehow turned that into 6 baths.
Made it even better. Yeah.
That's right. So the Times printed 6 baths. I don't think I've ever taken 6 baths, but I will tell you the pressure now to get myself to 6 baths is on. So,
well, is that connected to sort of the tradition in the Muslim tradition of faith of washing the feet, and there is sort of a—
It might be on an unconscious level.
Yeah.
You know, I call myself, a lot of my Jewish friends call themselves cultural Jews. I call myself a cultural Muslim. You know, you can walk away from whatever it is that you think you're walking away from, but it stays with you.
Yeah.
You know, you
meditate also for an hour a day. How important is that to you?
That's critical, because that's really been the mainstay of my sort of, you know, personal stability, like just being able to quiet down the noise enough to understand that there's a bigger picture always going on and that I can't get too wrapped up in the day-to-day. It doesn't mean that I don't focus on the day-to-day, but I think it just allows me enough space to be able to have the perspective to approach things maybe with more maturity than I would otherwise.
You know, you had this book out. You have a play opening up this Sunday, I believe.
Yeah,
am I right about
Center,
that? Disgraced, yeah. Hey, how are you finding time to a moment to carve out that time in a life that I'm sure is very frantic right now?
You know, I have just a couple rituals. You know, I definitely get at least a half an hour in before I go to sleep, and that's just – I just do that. And then I'll find a half an hour at some point during the day. It's really not too hard to do considering that I don't have much of a personal life with all that's going on in my life right now.
Is that a deliberate decision not to have a personal life right now?
Yeah. You know, I think I've just – there's been this huge explosion of creativity, and I just feel so – again, you know, I've spent so long – laboring and learning my trade, plying my trade, and now that there's been this boon, this very fruitful, fertile period, I just feel very responsible to it. I feel very grateful for it, and I just feel like whatever I can do to, you know, to do right by it is probably what I should be doing.
I mentioned your first play, Disgrace, begins its run in New York on Sunday, and it focuses on a dinner party based on an experience you once had. Tell us about that.
I was married for a few years, some years back, and my wife was French, and we had a dinner party with some another couple, you know, European and American guy from Detroit and a Viennese woman who was Jewish, and we were all friends, a very smart group of people, maybe all of them smarter than me, but you know, sort of New York urban young kind of thing, and you know, the conversation turned to Islam, and it turned to what was happening in Islam in Europe and what it was happening, and I think that my friends realize that my experience of being Muslim in this country, or my experience of being Muslim, actually ran much deeper than they realized, and it was much more part of my identity than they had ever accounted for. And I noticed in subtle ways how it changed their idea of me, and I saw that happen. I actually saw how it affected, you know, my ex-wife's idea of me just in the course of one evening, for her to see that other people were seeing me in a different way.
How do you think they were seeing you differently?
Somehow there was an otherness that somehow came into being. Like, I was just one of them. But then they realized, oh, wait, there's another side to him that we perceive as other. And so I had thought, what a great idea for a play where, you know, over the course of basically a single evening, relationships change just because of things that are said at a dinner table.
What an interesting idea. This is a good time for you creatively, you were saying. So what's next?
I'm working on my next book, and I'm working on a couple of plays. And I'd really, really, really like to get to a movie that I'd like to write, which I'd like to have, you know, be my directorial debut. So that's what's on the docket for the next year and a half, I'd say.
Do you feel there's any limit right now?
The limit is, you know, what me doing right by each of the projects and not getting too enthusiastic and spreading myself too thin, because, you know, I am just a person, and I, you know, am 41 at this point, and I, you know, it's not like I've got the energy of a 22-year-old. So I've got to pace myself, and I got to stay in shape. I got to stay in shape mentally, and I have to stay in shape physically. I have a good friend who's a screenwriter. I'll just finish up with this. In Hollywood, he says that, creativity for him and endurance in writing comes from the legs.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
There's a lot of truth to it, actually. If your legs are strong, you can write longer. That's what I've discovered.
Oh, that's interesting. I really enjoyed having you.
Me too. Thank you, Steve.
What a great conversation.
Thank you.
That's Ayed Akhtar. He speaks tonight at 7 at St. Paul's Episcopal Day School, 4041 Main Street. The event sponsored by Rainy Day Books and Fairway. For tickets, 913-384-3126. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow, three of the area's top chefs join us for a discussion on local food, creativity in their kitchens, and those pesky restaurant reviews, and more. Today's show is produced by Danny Alexander and Steven Steigman, with help from our new intern, Beth Lipoff. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.